When Beckett completed Molloy, he realized that his project somehow remained incomplete. He had farther to go, more to say. The second novel in what would eventually become a trilogy was called Malone Dies. This follows on from the previous two voices, especially Molloy's, taking another step into the darkness of the mind. The central character, Malone, is further removed from everyday reality, a fact that is apparent from the novel's opening words. "I shall soon be quite dead at last, in spite of all. Perhaps next month." Malone is an aged, impotent, bedridden figure on the point of death, and longing for death, but on his own terms, as far as this is possible. The voice of the novel is a voice approaching its own death. What matters now? It is by turns tragic, by turns hilarious, as Malone contemplates his own impotent ending. "I could die today if I wished, merely by making a little effort. But it is just as well to let myself die quietly, without rushing things. Something must have changed. I will not weigh upon the balance any more, one way or the other. I shall be neutral and inert. No difficulty there. Throes are the only trouble. I must be on guard against throes. But I am less given to them now since coming here. Of course, I still have my little fits of impatience from time to time." Malone has largely lost interest in his past, and instead of remembering, like Molloy, he passes his time and overcomes his boredom by occasionally inventing stories. Typical of these is the pitiful, pointless tale of Lambert and his family who live in misery on their squalid farm, in a hollow, flooded in winter and in summer, burnt to a cinder. The way to it leads through a fine meadow, but this fine meadow did not belong to the Lamberts. The only joy in life for Lambert is slaughtering pigs, which he does on an itinerant basis. Another tale is the grotesque love affair between Hairy Mac and Sucky Moll. This even inspires Malone to poetry. "To the lifelong promised land of the nearest cemetery, with his sucky hand in hand, love it is at last leads Hairy." Malone is inspired to ponder on the aged, impotent, and incompetent Hairy Mac. And one can only speculate on what he might have achieved if he had become acquainted with true sexuality at a less advanced age. I am lost. Not a word. The novel ends with Malone's voice in mid-story stuttering into the final inarticulate murmurings and silence of death. "Or light, light, I mean, never, there he will never, never anything, there, any more." The final novel of the trilogy is The Unnameable. There is no denying that this is the most difficult of all to read. Indeed, one unkind critic christened it The Unreadable. In keeping with the gradual denuding of humanity that afflicts the voices in Beckett's trilogy, the voice of the unnameable, who may be called Mahud, is that of someone who appears to exist in a limbo after death and before the full extinction of consciousness. Here Beckett takes his philosophical quest to discover what it is that we are and how to justify this state to ourselves to its ultimate conclusion. In Finnegan's Wake, Joyce had split the atom of the word, releasing a vast energy of illusion. Beckett set about dealing with the remnants. By this stage, language itself had fallen apart. "Where now? Who now? When now? Unquestioning. I say I. Unbelieving. Questions. Hypotheses, call them that. Keep going, going on. Call that going, call that on. Can it be that one day, off it goes on, that one day I simply stayed in where, instead of going out in the old way, out to spend day and night as far away as possible, it wasn't far. Perhaps that is how it began." Thus begins one of the most sustained assaults on the foundations of our existential awareness ever written. This opening passage of The Unnameable is arguably among the finest philosophical explorations of the 20th century. Much as the voice of the unnameable hovers between existence and non-existence, this passage may be understood as hovering between philosophy and literature. It is neither one nor the other. Too unaesthetic and fragmented to be literature, too personal, even in this reduced state, to be philosophy. Yet Beckett is telling us that this is the state to which all of philosophy, all literature, can be reduced. This is the earth out of which these separate specializations have flowered. From such fragmented essentials we build the entire edifice of human thought and expression. Founded on such quicksands rests the structure of all our humanity. As in the previous two novels of the trilogy, The Voice mentions previous characters in Beckett's oeuvre. But here it is not simply to refer to them, as if to some past point of navigation on the journey, but to dismiss them. All these Murphys, Malloys, and Malones, do not fool me. They have made me waste my time, suffer for nothing, speak of them when, in order to stop speaking, I should have spoken of me and of me alone. These previous attempts have been mere evasions of what it means to be himself. They have been voices smothering the voice which should have spoken of me. Yet the implication remains that this final unexpressed voice is ultimately silence. The voice of the unnameable is also, it would appear, an evasion. Even so, this voice reaches further toward that inexpressible voice than any before it. How can I know? I can't know. If I've spoken of him, I can only speak of me. No, I can't speak of anything, and yet I speak. Perhaps it's of him. I'll never know. How could I know? Who could know? And on it goes, in one long, unbroken flow of words for more than 100 paragraphless pages. This is Beckett's greatest achievement. Yet there is no denying its utter barrenness as art. This is arid territory in the extreme. It may have been necessary for Beckett to cross this territory. Call this going, call this on. But is it necessary for us, the put-upon readers? Do we have to endure all this? If we wish to partake in Beckett's profound divinations, the answer is yes. But many tend to agree with A.A. Alvarez, one of Beckett's most penetrating critics, who declared, "The unnameable appears flaccid and redundant. It seems to me a classic case of a work which is necessary but not sufficient, that is to say, personally necessary to Beckett in his exploration of his own limitless negation, but artistically insufficient because of its length, repetitiveness, and private claustrophobia." Beckett delighted in such philosophical distinctions between necessary and sufficient reason, which hark back to rationalist philosophers such as Descartes and Leibniz. If Beckett's trilogy is seen as an extended examination of Descartes' famous cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, then the unnameable is undoubtedly as close a scrutiny of the qualities inherent in sum, being, as one is likely to find. But any answer to set against Alvarez's objection must confront the question, is the experience evoked in the unnameable purely subjective, or does it have universal resonance? The answer here would appear to be that such depictions belong to Beckett's crisis-ridden psychology. Most, if not all of us, do not spend our time as nameless beings in a limbo on the verge of non-existence. Yet by the same count, most of us never see a starry night as depicted by Van Gogh. The psychological disintegration is in the end irrelevant to the work, whether it be art, literature, philosophy, or quasi-religious experience. Entering into the world of the unnameable, we are led to a heightened philosophical awareness of our existence. This may appear to be no wondrous experience, as it is when we enter into the vision of Van Gogh's starry night. The operative word here is appear. For Beckett's the unnameable is indeed a wondrous world, filled with insight into what, at its most reduced, is the nature of our condition. As Plato said, philosophy begins in wonder. The unnameable is also a work of wonder, in its own way as wondrous as Van Gogh's so very different vision. Where Van Gogh visualizes, Beckett wonders. He wonders in all senses of the word. He questions and he marvels. Just because his latter awareness is filled with a sense of the absurdity of existence does not in any way reduce its power. So they build up hypotheses which collapse on top of one another. It's human. A lobster couldn't do it. Ah, nice mess we're in, the whole pack of us. Is it possible we're all in the same boat? No, we're in a nice mess, each in his own peculiar way. I myself have been scandalously bungled. They must be beginning to realize it. Until the voice of the unnameable finally fades away amidst the murmurs, having come to no conclusion other than the fact that there is no conclusion in any sense, except ultimate silence. It will be I. It will be the silence, where I am. I don't know. I'll never know. In the silence you don't know. You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on.
Surprising though it may seem, Beckett's precision at this final point, and others in the unnameable, leaves much open to the reader.
These are the final words, the ultimate gasp of consciousness. Read them as a slow, finally diminishing, murmurous gasping as they fade before death, and they become an acquiescence to the silence, to nothingness. Read them as the last, desperate, ravening attempt of the voice to finally grasp itself and arrive at some form of understanding, and they become altogether something else. They may contain all the human fear of death. They may become a final defiance, a gesture against inevitable oblivion, even a final absurdity or an ultimate agony. It might be difficult to read the unnameable in more than limited doses, but it is open to the acclimatization of any mind. Each passage can be the gnomic prose poem of our own experience. Beckett worked in pared-down language, a reductionist vocabulary that he made very much his own. He insisted upon extreme control of his words, his phrases, even to the extent of controlling how we breathe them, how we absorb them. There is an onward flow made up of phrased breaths, lulling us into the rhythm of his voice, his thoughts. But curiously, it is this very control of his words which gives us such a great freedom in experiencing them. Precision in this one aspect allows us freedom in many others. A passage that we may read as tragedy one day can easily appear hilarious the next time we read it. Beckett may have been unable to grasp the impossible, but he knew very well what he was leaving open to the possible. The trilogy consists of monologues, with no director's instructions on how they should be read. We are the directors. We each learn from Beckett in our own way. The voices are enlivened by what each one of us puts into them. When Beckett had finished the second work of his trilogy, Malone Dies, he found himself at loose ends. To take his mind off things before facing up to the psychological rigours of the unnameable, he began writing the play that eventually became Waiting for Godot. As Beckett himself put it, he began to write Godot as a relaxation, to get away from the awful prose I was writing at the time. Awful, in this context, refers to the experience of writing the trilogy rather than making a qualitative judgment on its style. Beckett was certainly aware of what he was achieving, though like any artist moving into new territory, he had to live with the prospect that the critics might indeed dismiss his efforts as awful. It was ironic that this diversion, which Beckett now began writing, should eventually prove to be his best-known work. Waiting for Godot is at present the most frequently performed 20th-century play throughout the world. Yet the entire drama centres on two derelict characters who do little other than fritter away their time, waiting for Godot. Accounting for the play's popularity is thus no easy matter. With some justice, this two-act drama has been described as a play where nothing happens twice. Others claim that it captures, in essence, the nihilistic philosophy that best characterises the 20th century. Still others insist that it expresses a particular state of human mental evolution, one which civilized humanity has evolved to come to terms with the rigors and uncertainties, horrors and transformations that continue to underlie the comforts and apparent certainties of modern life. At the same time, there is no denying that had Waiting for Godot been staged as a medieval mystery play, its medieval audience would probably have recognized and understood many of its themes. A peasant audience of the era that experienced the Black Death would have empathized with two suffering tramps in a blighted landscape, their endless waiting for the arrival of Godot, their preoccupation with redemption, and the futility of a world in which Godot was absent, to say nothing of their absurd philosophical bickering and the broad slapstick humor of their situation. Waiting for Godot is both archetypically 20th century and as timeless as its reduced characters in their empty landscape. Humanity of all ages has found itself, at least momentarily, in a world where Godot appears to be absent, a world just as impossible to understand as that which Beckett portrays. Here, it would appear, is the ultimate much ado about nothing. Yet it surely must be about something. So what exactly is Waiting for Godot about? To put the obvious question in its most blatant form, is Godot God? Are the two main characters, Vladimir and Estragon, waiting for some kind of divine revelation? Beckett always strongly denied that Godot was God, one of the few points on which he was uncharacteristically explicit and adamant regarding his work. But the fact remains that Godot, at least to English audiences, does contain the word God. On the other hand, to a German audience it would appear to contain an elision of Gott and Tod, God and death, as perhaps in God is dead. The latter would appear to be a more likely explanation for those who require such crass simplicities. Beckett certainly detested this type of narrowing down of his work, not wishing it to be blighted by literalist interpretations. We should not search for a key to the inherent enigma. This is precisely what his work is not about. The puzzle has no correct answer. The situation cannot be resolved. If answer we need, we should seek it within ourselves and keep it there. The purpose of the play, if purpose it can be called, is to remind us of the essential situation in which we find ourselves. Waiting for Godot is a tragicomedy about atmosphere, situation, and condition, much more than it is about meaning. Its meaning could well be explained as the absence of meaning. Its action is the response of the characters to the futile situation in which they find themselves. This response is both heart-rending and hilarious. Vladimir goes towards Estragon, contemplates him a moment, then shakes him awake. Estragon, wild gestures, incoherent words, finally, "Why will you never let me sleep?" Vladimir, "I felt lonely." Estragon, "I was dreaming I was happy." Vladimir, "That passed the time." Estragon, "I was dreaming that..." Vladimir, violently, "Don't tell me!" One must always bear in mind that Beckett wrote Waiting for Godot as a divertissement from the awful confrontation of his prose. The comedy is often farcical, in the manner of early Chaplin. Elements, especially in the tramp-like appearance of Vladimir and Estragon, are purposely Chaplinesque. Their actions likewise, with dropping trousers and other ludicrous incidents. At the same time, the relationship between these two main characters bears many similarities to that of Laurel and Hardy. They are both fond of each other and exasperated with each other. Despite their differences, they are, in their different ways, utterly dependent upon each other. They could not survive alone. Their exchanges both goad and encourage. They enable them to pass the time, to avoid facing up to their situation. Their endless conversation contains much affectionate, well-honed repartee. According to Beckett's friends, his wrangling conversations with Suzanne often took on this same conscious music hall quality of ritual and repartee. This appears to have first developed during their long trek south through war-torn France as a means of overcoming the tedium and suffering of their journey. Vladimir, sententious, "To every man his little cross," he sighs, "till he dies," afterthought, "and is forgotten." Estragon, "In the meantime, let us try and converse calmly, since we are incapable of keeping silent." Vladimir, "You're right, we're inexhaustible." Estragon, "It's so we won't think." Vladimir, "We have that excuse." Estragon, "It's so we won't hear." Vladimir, "We have our reasons." The scenery, or lack of it, a country road, a tree, would seem to depict some featureless rural spot somewhere in France, though it could almost as easily be some barren spot in the Wicklow Mountains, where Beckett had spent so much time on lonely walks, listening to the voices of his own mind, arguing with himself. Vladimir is the tall, thin, intellectual figure who has seen better times. Estragon is short and fat, with occasional female undertones to his character. Vladimir, "Do you remember the Gospels?" Estragon, "I remember the maps of the Holy Land. Coloured they were, very pretty. The Dead Sea was pale blue. The very look of it made me thirsty. 'That's where we'll go,' I used to say. 'That's where we'll go for our honeymoon. We'll swim, we'll be happy.'" Vladimir, "You should have been a poet." Estragon, "I was." Gesture towards his rags. "Isn't that obvious?" Silence. Vladimir. Where was I? How's your foot? Estragon. Swelling visibly. Along with the misery, there is, of course, the tedium. As Estragon puts it, nothing happens, nobody comes, nobody goes, it's awful. At one point on their blasted heath, however, Vladimir and Estragon encounter another strange couple, Potso and Lucky. The self-important Potso carries a whip and leads his servant Lucky by a rope around his neck. Lucky is weighed down, carrying his master's various possessions, including a picnic basket and a stool. Potso and Lucky appear as a parody of the master-servant relationship, but there are also elements of psychological metaphor here, with Potso as the ego or even commanding superego, and Lucky as the unconscious mind. Before they take their leave, Potso makes Lucky give a performance in which he thinks aloud, whereupon Lucky simply opens his mouth and delivers a torrent of words, an uninterrupted jumble of nonsense and cliché, continuing in a flow of association. Lucky. Fulham, Clapham, in a word, the dead loss per caput since the death of Bishop Berkeley being to the tune of 1 inch 4 ounce per caput, approximately, by and large, more or less, to the nearest decimal, good measure, round figures, stark naked in stockinged feet in Connemara. Potso and Lucky proceed on their way, but are encountered again in the second act. This time Potso is blind, and Lucky is dumb. Lucky is still carrying Potso's possessions, but he is now leading Potso, who follows him by hanging onto the rope around Lucky's neck. Despite this, Potso is still very much in charge. Again, their relationship is open to political or psychological interpretation, but is best appreciated as the farcical personal situation it purports to be. Here is Laurel and Hardy taken one step further. Instead of a loose, knockabout personal relationship, as with Vladimir and Estragon, we now have an inflexible power relationship. As Potso prepares to leave, Estragon asks him, "Where do you go from here?" Potso replies simply, "On." Such purposeless endurance is a theme that runs throughout the play. The first act ends. Silence. Estragon. "Well, shall we go?" Vladimir. "Yes, let's go." They do not move. The second act finally ends in identical fashion. The bemused, chastened, or entertained audience eventually breaks the ensuing silence with sporadic and then mounting applause, frequently interspersed with cheers, boos, and catcalls. Waiting for Godot had a mixed reception from the beginning, and there is something about its challenging informality and apparent formlessness that seems to release an audience from its inhibitions. Few leave the theatre without their own very definite opinions having been provoked. No one wishes to feel that he or she has been made a fool of, either in the theatre or in real life. And life or drama, in Beckettian form, can easily be seen as a load of rubbish, or alternatively, as refreshingly free from comforting preconceptions. Stoic indifference among audiences of Beckett's plays is rare. When Beckett finally completed both Waiting for Godot and his trilogy, he lapsed into apathetic exhaustion. The psychological toll involved in the intense introspection of the trilogy had been immense. In the midst of this, his mother fell seriously ill, and it became clear that she had not long to live. Beckett returned to Dublin, where all the guilt and angst he had experienced with regard to his mother surfaced once more as he attended her deathbed, watching her die. After the funeral, he returned to Paris, where his constant state of despair was punctuated by nights of drinking. His failure as a human being and as an artist now seemed all but complete. A photograph from this period shows a skeletally thin figure with a bemused, all but defeated expression.
Yet he had done what he had felt impelled to do.
The artist in him had fulfilled himself in his own willful way. In his perversity, he had undeniably achieved uniqueness. But the self-lacerating human being in him was aware that what he had produced was all but incomprehensible to anyone else. No one would ever want to read such unreadable prose, let alone put on such undramatic drama. Although Beckett appeared no longer to believe in himself, one person at least still retained faith in his baffling work. This was Suzanne. She reproached Beckett for not sending out his manuscripts. He merely shrugged, telling her to do whatever you want with them. so she decided she would do just that. If Beckett wouldn't attempt to have his work published or performed, she would. Tenaciously she lugged his manuscripts from one small Parisian publisher to another, leaving the manuscript of Waiting for Godot at the door of a succession of small avant-garde theatres. It was only through her persistence, in the face of any number of puzzled or dismissive rejections, that Beckett's work ever saw the light of day. In 1951, Suzanne's efforts finally came to fruition, of a kind. A French editor with a soft spot for Ireland and all things Celtic imagined he had come across a typical example of classic Irish humour, a rarity which was all but unknown in French translation. As a result, Molloy, and then Malone Dies, were eventually published in French in a limited edition by Édition de Minuit, Midnight Editions, the former clandestine resistance publishers. The appearance of these two difficult novels attracted a few favourable mentions in avant-garde literary magazines, but little widespread recognition or commercial success, causing the publishers to abandon the idea of bringing out The Unnameable. Instead, they issued the script of Waiting for Godot, which appeared in 1952. Some months later, the owner of the tiny Théâtre de Babylone on the Left Bank agreed to stage the play. Although neither Beckett nor Suzanne realized it, he had already given up on the theatre. "I'm going to close up shop, and I may as well close up on a beauty," he told Beckett's friend, Roger Blinn, the avant-garde director who had agreed to see the play through production. So rehearsals began. Despite Beckett's shyness, he soon began taking an increasingly interfering and dominant role in these sessions. As one of the actors remarked, "Beckett does not want his actors to act. He wants them to do what he tells them. When they try to act, he becomes very angry." Beckett knew precisely what he wanted. "There is nothing more grotesque than tragedy," he explained cryptically. His plays were not intended to be naturalistic, more ritualistic. The parts required an interpretation that was stylized rather than psychological. Yet, despite his increasing involvement, he refused to give any hint to the actors of the meaning of what was taking place on the stage. Beckett would always insist upon taking such a leading role in the production of his plays. This can in part be explained by his origins as a novelist, where the medium is simply words of which the writer remains in complete control. Also, there is no doubt that Beckett's plays did, at least initially, required a certain mannered production in order to achieve their own conviction. After all, audiences had simply never seen anything like this before. Later, however, Beckett's mania for control would have a cramping effect on his dramatic works, and even today his trustees, who hold the performance rights, retain a severely restrictive control over productions of his work. Beckett's plays will surely take on a new, unforeseen lease of life when this control is relaxed. The first performance of Waiting for Godot was staged on January 5, 1953. Beckett stayed away, unable to face the ordeal of witnessing his own first night. The audience, seated on 230 folding chairs in a cramped space, was bewildered. But a number of perceptive critics immediately recognized the play's originality and worth. Beckett was acclaimed as one of today's best playwrights, and it was predicted that his play would be spoken of for a long time. Waiting for Godot struck a chord with the post-war nihilism of existentialist Paris, where Jean-Paul Sartre was the philosopher king, and Juliette Gréco's fatalistic songs were all the rage in the cafes of the Latin Quarter. The audiences at Waiting for Godot remained baffled, but continued to fill the tiny theatre night after night. Soon, all Paris knew that something special was taking place at the Théâtre de Babylone. The tide had finally turned, and Beckett was on his way to achieving the recognition of which he had so long secretly dreamt. Productions of Waiting for Godot were soon opening in London, 1955, the United States, 1956, and then throughout the world. International reactions were remarkably similar. Packed audiences were bewildered, and often the theatres were more than half empty after intermission. But many critics recognised that this was the play that somehow seemed appropriate to our age. The drama of the two tramps who did nothing, twice over, was more than a reflection of fashionable Parisian angst. It touched something in the very soul of modern humanity. Night after night, audiences filled the theatres to be bewildered and boo, or to have their eyes opened and applaud. Controversy rather than acceptance was the initial ingredient that contributed to Beckett's success, and soon Waiting for Godot was being performed on avant-garde stages and small theatres from Santiago to Stockholm. In the process of becoming an underground hit, it gradually established itself as a permanent classic of the world's theatre repertoire. Beckett, meanwhile, returned to his desk. Following the completion of his trilogy, he produced 13 brief Texts for Nothing, which he referred to as an afterbirth of the trilogy.
The monologist prose is similar, as well as being similarly difficult and rewarding, to that of the unnameable.
The voice questions its condition, attempting to grasp the ever-elusive truth of its being. The philosophical quest resembles a snake attempting to swallow its own tail. No voice ever but in my life, it says, if speaking of me one can speak of life, and it can. As ever, even at his most impenetrable, Beckett's words are seldom devoid of graveyard humour. Did I try everything, ferret in every hold, secretly, silently, patiently, listening? I'm in earnest, as so often. I'd like to be sure I left no stone unturned before reporting me missing and giving up. The attempt remains as ambitious as ever. I'm the clerk, I'm the scribe, at the hearings of what cause I know not. Why want it to be mine? I don't want it. Or, where would I go if I could go? Who would I be if I could be? What would I say if I had a voice? Who says this, saying it's me? After these texts, Beckett returned once more to the theatre, eventually producing his second major drama, Endgame. This features the dying Ham, in black glasses, confined to his wheelchair. He is attended by his servant, the recalcitrant Clove. Also present are Ham's mother and father, Nag and Nell, who inhabit dustbins, having apparently lost their legs many years previously in a bicycle accident. The characters' roles are indicated by their names. Ham, hammer. Clove, clou is French for nail. Nag, nagel is German for nail. And Nell, Irish accent, nail. There are, of course, many other allusions. Ham, as in ham actor, nag to nag, even Nell, as in the tolling of the death knell. All the action takes place in a claustrophobic spherical structure with two high windows resembling the inside of a skull. The outside of the skull appears to be a landscape after a nuclear holocaust. Thus the characters may also be seen as the elements of a mind as it faces death and final extinction. So far so bad. The title Endgame refers to the last moves in a chess game, with Ham as the king desperately trying to avoid the checkmate of death. This is all very unrelentingly grim, and although the play certainly has its humorous moments, the atmosphere remains persistently oppressive, not to say depressive. Unlike Waiting for Godot, there is no looseness, either of action or inaction, resonance or repartee. The author is more in control, and yet the words have none of the bleak memorableness of Godot. This said, the play is not without its moments. Clove, despairingly. Ah! Ham. Something from your heart? Clove. My heart? Ham. A few words. From your heart. Pause. Clove, fixed gaze, tonelessly, towards auditorium. They said to me, that's love, yes, yes, no doubt, now you see how. Ham. Articulate. Clove, as before. How easy it is. They said to me, that's friendship, yes, yes, no question, you've found it. They said to me, here's the place, stop, raise your head and look at all that beauty, that order. They said to me, come now, you're not a brute beast. Think upon these things and you'll see how all becomes clear and simple. They said to me, what skilled attention they get, all these dying of their wounds. Ham.
Enough!
The unremitting bleakness of Endgame was not so well received, but it is now generally regarded as a masterpiece of its kind, second, though a long way second, to Waiting for Godot. As if to show that he was not entirely lost in depression, Beckett now turned to another divertissement, a brief dramatic work entitled Crap's Last Tape. This was written in English, and Beckett's easy familiarity with his mother tongue enabled his imagination to take wing. Crap's Last Tape is too short to be considered a major masterpiece, The entire script, including copious stage directions, covers just 9 pages, but in other aspects it may well be compared to Waiting for Godot. It is also the most accessible and most obviously personal, in the literal realistic sense, of his later works. The central and only appearing character is Crap, an echo of the name given by Beckett to the autobiographical character in his earlier failed play Eleutheria. But here, Crap takes on a life of his own. No longer derisively autobiographical, he becomes intensely so, and in doing so transcends his particularities to become one of the great archetypal characters of the modern stage. He is by turns funny, pathetic, farcical, and deeply touching, all in the space of such a brief stage life. The curtain goes up to reveal Crap in his sparse and decrepit den. He is an old man playing over and again the tapes that he has recorded during his life. These tapes are a form of journal in which he describes what has happened to him and also summarizes his current attitude to life. We hear his resolutions, his criticisms of his former self, his regrets. We witness the older Crap listening to the younger man recounting his most poignant memories, the death of his mother, his love, his great moments of inspiration. These minutes on stage imply volumes, evoking an entire life as well as the feeling of its unfulfillment and irretrievability. The older Crap and the younger Crap both speak. They are two different people, the one unheard by the other, the one a stranger to the other. We hear their separate voices, but there is no dialogue. They can never speak to each other. The past can never be repaired. Crap, playing and rewinding the spools of his ancient recording machine, meditatively munching on his bananas, occasionally disappearing into the darkness for a swig of hooch, is one of the most moving figures of the modern stage, despite his brief stage life, which remains in the mind long after it is witnessed. At the end, we leave the aged Crap with his sour cud and iron stool, listening bitterly to the callow judgment and hope of his younger voice on the tape. Tape. Perhaps my best years are gone, when there was a chance of happiness. But I wouldn't want them back, not with a fire in me now. No, I wouldn't want them back. Crap, motionless, staring before him. The tape runs on in silence. Curtain. In 1960, Beckett began another novel, which was eventually called Comment C'est. In English, this is translated as How It Is, which loses the resonances of the French title, Comment C'est, to begin, and Comme on sait, how one knows. Here Beckett faced an apparently insurmountable problem. How was he to progress beyond the apparent dead end of the unnameable? How was he to go any further than that expiring monologue without going back on himself? How was he to create a novel when he had, to all intents and purposes, killed off this genre to his own satisfaction? Taking a cue from his plays, Beckett gave the central voice a setting, though in keeping with his plays this was bleak in the extreme. The initially unnamed narrator is crawling through a sea of mud, in the course of which he encounters various similar figures. Behind them they all drag their few miserable possessions tied up in sacks. During the second part of the novel, the narrator encounters Pym, in the course of which he reveals that his own name is Bomb. This encounter is a grotesque parody of human intercourse, in all senses, as the two figures grapple and entwine in the mud before going on their separate ways. Bomb characterizes himself as hanging on by the fingernails to one's condition, and this is certainly no exaggeration. During the course of his progress through the mud, he has occasional vivid memories of a more realistic life. Some of these are distinctly autobiographical, though the suicide of Baum's wife appears to be a mélange of quasi-autobiographical guilt and wish-fulfillment. Things were not going well with Suzanne. This novel, if such it can be called, consists entirely of brief, unpunctuated paragraphs, which appear to incorporate their own breath-like rhythm, if not meaning. This voice, these voices, no knowing, not meaning a choir, no, no, only one, but qua, qua, meaning on all sides, megaphones, possible, technique, something wrong here. Wrong for never twice the same, unless time vast tracts, aged out of recognition, no for often fresher, stronger after than before, unless sickness, sorrow, they sometimes pass, one feels better less wretched after than before. Unlike the similarly unreadable, unnameable, How It Is has meagre rewards for those who persist with the narrator across this mired literary bogland. From it I learned what little remained, learn what little remains of how it was before Pym, with Pym, after Pym, and how it is, for that too it found words. And so on, for pages on end, without relief. The critics were baffled, and even some of Beckett's most dedicated aficionados confessed themselves at a loss. In destroying the novel, this time Beckett appeared to have destroyed his own writing. By now Beckett's life with Suzanne had descended into a characteristic farce. His general behaviour and attitude toward the world, to say nothing of his heavy drinking and occasional affairs, made him impossible to live with. After all, he too found it all but impossible to live with himself. He and Suzanne still shared an apartment, but had come to a unique arrangement. Inside the front door, the apartment had two doors, one leading to his separate quarters, the other leading to hers. When Beckett wanted to communicate with Suzanne, he called her on the telephone. Despite this apparent alienation, their bond remained deep. They shared too much ever to part fully. Beckett never forgot all that Suzanne had done for him, the tireless efforts she had made to unload his manuscripts on uninterested readers. She was also the one who had lived with him and stood by him during his times of greatest travail. She alone had witnessed and shared his deepest miseries. In 1961, Beckett decided to marry Suzanne, as a show of good faith, as a recognition of what she had done, and to ensure that if he died, she would inherit the considerable fortune that was accumulating from the worldwide royalties earned by his works. Typically, they travelled in secret to England, where they were married without fuss or friends, in the anonymous coastal town of Folkestone. Beckett's only indication of where he was, or what he was doing, was a typically oblique postcard to a friend in Paris. Blood flows more calmly in the town of Harvey. William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of the blood, was born in Folkestone in 1578. From now on, Beckett increasingly busied himself with translations of his own work from French into English, as well as overseeing productions of his own plays in English, French, and German, in which he was also fluent. In between he wrote a number of more or less successful dramaticules and short prose pieces. Among these was a brief film script entitled simply Film. This was to star the great silent movie actor Buster Keaton, whose expressionless stone face had become his nickname and stock in trade. Beckett was a great admirer of Keaton, and in 1964 travelled to New York to assist in the production of Film. The ageing Keaton agreed to emerge from his full-time poker-playing retirement only because he needed the money. His initial reaction was to declare that the apparently simple but philosophically profound script was quite beyond him. After a few contretemps, he moodily went through the motions in front of the camera with no attempt to act. Beckett was delighted. This was precisely what he required. Alas, off-screen, Keaton continued simply to go through the motions, and there was no meeting of minds between these two great stone faces of the 20th century. Beckett's shorter prose pieces are another acquired taste. They are by turn elusive and allusive. Despite such difficulty, they are well worth the effort. Readers will discover their own favourites among these more or less impenetrable texts. One of the more successful is the 1963 piece Imagination Dead Imagine, in which the central voice attempts to do just that, coming to the realisation, "No, life ends, and no, there is nothing elsewhere, and no question now of ever finding again that white speck lost in whiteness." In October 1969, Beckett learned that he had won the Nobel Prize for Literature. At the time he was holidaying at a remote coastal resort in Tunisia. To his horror, the world's press descended upon his hotel, and he was besieged in his room. The pathologically shy and retiring Beckett was eventually persuaded to present himself to the press, where he faced a barrage of cameras. He was too overcome to reply to their questions, and simply sat there with his head bowed as if in shame. His health, frail at the best of times, took some time to recover from the shock. On his return to Paris, Beckett took up his translations again, occasionally producing another short prose piece or dramaticule. These latter are for the most part boldly experimental. For instance, Breath consists of just a page of instructions. Its setting is an empty stage littered with rubbish. No verticals, all scattered and lying. The action, such as it is, consists of a cry, later repeated, and the amplified recording of a deep breath, which inhales and then exhales. Inspiration, expiration, in the words of the stage directions, while a dim light slowly increases and then decreases. The entire drama takes less than a minute. Yet in the right circumstances, it can produce a striking effect, giving pause for thought. Our breath is our very life, our inspiration and our expiration. What could be more simple? This, basically, is all we are. Some of these dramaticules work, others are strangely unsatisfactory, being both slight and profound at the same time. But even in this form, Beckett was able to produce the occasional masterpiece. One among these is Not I. It is, again, reductionist in the extreme. The stage is in darkness, with a spotlight focused on a mouth, which speaks through a hole in the black backcloth. Downstage is a dark, listening figure. The female mouth speaks in a torrent of disjointed, all but meaningless words. Gradually the effect of the naked, isolated mouth and its jumble of words and phrases takes on a mesmerizing and powerful meaning of its own. So disconnected, never got the message, or powerless to respond, like numbed, couldn't make the sound, not any sound, no sound of any kind, no screaming for help, for example, should she feel so inclined. Scream, screams, then listen, silence, screams again, then listen again, silence, no, spared that. The effect is both horrific and tragic, and appears to express the being of humanity on a deeply fundamental level. It is primitive, inarticulate, yet seems to be groping toward some extreme of articulacy. No idea what she was saying. Imagine. No idea what she was saying. Till she began trying to delude herself. It was not hers at all. Not her voice at all. And no doubt would have. Vital she should. After 15 minutes of this, the audience is aware that it is undergoing a profound and primal experience. The precise nature of the experience remains elusive, causing us to ponder on it long after the event. In some performances, Not I is repeated after an interval. Curiously, this does not always work. The piece is best seen and heard on its own and then left at that. The sight of that almost obscene, isolated mouth giving voice to the words takes on a tonic life of its own. Now can't stop. Imagine. Can't stop the stream. And the whole brain begging. Something begging in the brain. Begging the mouth to stop. This is the stream. The scream. The unstoppable, unbearable torrent of consciousness, the unending, unstoppable voice in the head that goes on regardless of sense, of meaning, of suffering. How our life is comprised of this unending gossip which goes on and on in our brain, yet in a way, ultimately this is all we have. The short prose pieces that Beckett continued to write were, for the most part, less successful, but they too contained occasional flashes of genius, such as could not have been produced by anyone else. Beckett was determined to go on, no matter what, as he put it encouragingly, "Fail again, fail better." Among the more successful of these pieces are Lessness, Enough, and Old Earth, the last of which begins with the memorable, "Old Earth no more lies." These pieces attempt to reach the very heart of the human experience, to grasp our essential being, to gain inklings into what, ultimately, experience is. This is literature so close to philosophy as to be indistinguishable. It is a form of creative philosophy, and as such harks back to Descartes' I think, therefore I am. One of Descartes' best-known works is his Meditations, and this is precisely what he was doing when he was philosophizing. meditating upon what he called the first or ultimate philosophy. These later pieces of Beckett's short prose may also be seen as meditations on the process of living and thinking, attempts to come to terms with and understand the full import of Descartes' famous conclusion. Beckett's meditations include both more and less of our humanity than Descartes'. They discard the rational calm of Descartes, the civilized vision of the Enlightenment. Beckett's voices, his beings, express all our irrational fears, yet always retain an element of their rationality. Even when reason is lost, it is eventually regained, so that its absence can be rationally assessed and the endurance can continue. The endurance itself, I must go on, is a persistence far deeper than rationality. It is the persistence of life itself. This is how our being evolved. This is how we emerged from the primeval slime to become what we are. Beckett's vision remains open to all manner of irrationality. We are all born mad, some remain so. Yet at the same time it is focused by its reductionism. They give birth astride a grave. The light gleams an instant. Then it's night once more. Beckett concentrates upon that gleaming instant like no other. In his late 70s, Beckett's years of ill health and heavy drinking began to tell. In 1986 he became prey to recurrent bouts of giddiness, which caused him to have several serious falls both at home and in the street. By now Suzanne was in her mid-80s and ailing too. Age had caused a deterioration in her normally stoic character. As a result, she suffered from bouts of anger, much of which she directed at Beckett. For his part, Beckett was deeply upset by this turn of events. In 1987, he moved into an old people's home. This was a modest establishment, and Beckett lived in a sparse room with just a few books and his bottle of Irish whiskey in the cupboard. Outside was a bleak garden, with a single Godot-like tree. Friends who called were shocked at Beckett's impoverished quarters, but he refused to spend his considerable fortune on anything better. He had all that he needed. In July 1989, Suzanne died, and the 83-year-old Beckett followed her 5 months later, December the 22nd, 1989. Afterword. To add an afterword, after such ultimate words as Beckett's, would seem more than presumptuous. Still, it is worth briefly considering the afterlife of his words. Beckett's works continue to divide their readers and audiences, and the feelings evoked are seldom less than impassionate. Sam is either a great personal favourite, subject to much hero worship, or Beckett is reviled as a load of pretentious nonsense, as filled with rubbish as the stages of his plays. In the eyes of his admirers, Beckett has attained the canon of great literature. Such status is extremely difficult to achieve, but once achieved is all but impossible to lose. It is doubtful that Beckett's detractors, even the most learned, commonsensical, or prestigious, will succeed in dethroning him, while each new generation of young readers finds such rapport with his works. Pessimism such as Beckett's always has its appeal. It mocks experience, authority, and achievement, all that stand in the way of the young. Yet the appeal of Beckett's perversely determined brand of pessimism is not limited to the young. It has an ability to withstand the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to which youth may be particularly prone, but which in old age become a permanent condition. The philosophy of such pessimism bursts the rainbow soap bubbles of illusion, leaving us blinking with stinging eyes at unremitting reality. Yet such defeatism is no soft option. Beckett had iron in his soul. His was the wry humour of those with fortitude, those who withstand all misfortune. His voices may be those of the defeated, of the truly hopeless in their various guises, but the fact is that they never admitted final defeat. In the silence you don't know, you must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on. Beckett's chief works in English. Beckett translated almost all of his own later works from French into English. These translations are often slightly different from the originals, and unlike so many translations, are literary works in their own right, quite the equal of their originals. Horoscope, 1930. More Pricks Than Kicks, 1934. Echoes, Bones and Other Precipitates, 1935. Murphy, 1938. Waiting for Godot, 1953. Watt, 1953. Malloy, 1955. Malone Dies, 1956. The Unnameable, 1958. Endgame, 1958. Crap's Last Tape, 1958. Embers, 1959. How It Is, 1964. Film, 1964. Imagination Dead Imagine, 1965. Texts for Nothing, 1967. Breath, 1969. Not I, 1972. Mercier and Camier, 1974. Old Earth, 1974. All That Fall, 1979. Chronology of Beckett's Life and Times. 1906, Samuel Beckett born on Good Friday, April the 13th, second son of William and May Beckett at Fox Rock, South Dublin, Ireland. 1914 to 1918, World War I. 1916, Easter Rising in Dublin by Irish patriots against British rule. 1922, Ireland gains independence from Britain, with Ulster, Northern Ireland, remaining British. 1922 to 1923, Irish Civil War. 1920 to 1923, Beckett becomes boarder at Portora Royal School in Ulster. 1923 to 1927, studies modern languages, English, French, Italian, at Trinity College, Dublin. 1927, wins gold medal for best scholar in final exams. 1927 to 1928, Beckett teaches for 2 terms at Campbell College, Belfast. 1928, goes to Paris as reader at École Normale Supérieure, meets James Joyce. 1929, Wall Street crash signals worldwide Great Depression. Beckett's first publication, essay, Dante, Bruno, Vico, Joyce. 1930, Beckett's poem Horoscope wins Cunard Prize in Paris. 1930 to 1932, becomes lecturer in French at Trinity College, Dublin. Resigns after 4 terms. 1931, publishes Proust in London. 1932, beginning of Beckett's 5 years of wandering in Germany, France, England and Ireland. 1933, Hitler comes to power in Germany. Beckett's father dies, leaving him small private income. Begins 2 year stay in Chelsea, London. 1934, Beckett undergoes period of psychoanalysis, publishes collection of short stories, More Pricks Than Kicks, in London. 1935, breaks off psychoanalysis, publishes collection of poems Echoes, Bones and Other Precipitates, in Paris. 1937, settles permanently in Paris. 1938, seriously wounded in stabbing incident in Montmartre, lives together with Suzanne de Chevaux-Dumenil, first novel, Murphy, published in London. 1939, outbreak of World War II in which Ireland remains neutral. 1940, German invasion and occupation of France, Beckett registers as neutral national, living in Paris. 1941, joins cell of underground French resistance. 1942, resistance cell in which Beckett is involved, penetrated by Germans. Beckett and Suzanne flee Paris for south of France, eventually settle at Roussillon in unoccupied Vichy France. Beckett supports himself as farm labourer and begins writing What? 1944, Paris liberated by Allied troops. Beckett and Suzanne return to Paris. 1945, end of World War II. Beckett returns to Ireland, finishes writing What? Returns to France, working for Irish Red Cross in Normandy. Awarded Croix de Guerre for his work in French resistance. Begins writing in French. 1946 to 1947, highly creative period of writing in French, produces novels, stories and a play, none of which are published. 1947, beginning of Siege in the Room, writes Malloy. 1947 to 1948, writes Malone Meurt, Malone dies. 1948 to 1949, writes En attendant Godot, waiting for Godot. 1949 to 1950, writes L'innommable, The Unnameable. 1950, Beckett's mother dies. 1950 to 1952, writes Texte pour rien, Texts for Nothing. 1951, Molloy and Malone Meurthe, first two novels of the trilogy, published in Paris. 1952, En attendant Godot, published in Paris. 1953, first staging of En attendant Godot at Théâtre de Babylone on Left Bank in Paris. 1955 to 1956, writes Fin de partie, end game. 1958, writes Krapp's Last Tape. 1960, writes Comment c'est, How It Is. 1961, marries Suzanne de Chauveau-Dumesnil at Folkestone in England. 1964, flies to New York for making of Film with Buster Keaton. 1969, awarded Nobel Prize for Literature. 1972, first production of Not I. 1974, writes Old Earth. 1989, death of Beckett at age 83. This concludes the reading of Beckett in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Copyright 2005 by Paul Strathern. This book was read by Robert Whitfield.
This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Ivan R. D. and was produced in 2009 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.
If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.